This is Arthur Mansfield, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee via Skype on the 28th of May 2013. Arthur Mansfield, Part 1.
Arthur Mansfield. I was born in Wandsworth in London in 1926, the 29th of March.
So you are now...
87.
Would you say your father had been an educated man?
No.
What did he do?
No, my father served in the First World War, and when he came out, he'd been in the Royal Engineers and got into communications. And when he came out, he joined the General Post Office as a telephone linesman. And really, that was his basic career. And he was self-schooled from that time onwards. But this was he attended night schools to improve his abilities. But he eventually ran a I think a fairly successful team, which of all things put up telephone lines. And and that was quite adventurous in the days when the lines going over places like Shap Fell and the Pennines would get covered in frozen rime and come crashing to the ground. So he always enjoyed these adventures, being sent with his team to repair the damage. But that was his career until the Second World War. And he was called up, in fact, several days before the war began, and spent the whole war in North Africa and Italy, doing the same job, communications, but essentially the external communications, such as telephone lines and so on.
If it hadn't been for chaps like your dad, we would not be speaking now, do we?
I suppose so, yes.
It's a very thin, wandering line that comes to Betton Strange in Shropshire, I can tell you. What about your education, Arthur? What kind of schooling did you have?
I suppose I was a bright little fellow at elementary school and managed to get a place at Rutledge School in Merton in Surrey, which was an extremely good grammar school. And so I spent 7 years there. And at the end of that time, I managed to get another scholarship to Cambridge this time. I went to study agriculture, but when I went for my interview, the Dean of Agriculture, who was a namesake, said, "We don't want people like you." He said, our course is basically for... people who have a stake in the land. But so he said, what's your real interest? And I said, well, zoology. And he said, well, I'll speak to the county authorities who awarded the scholarship and tell them that you'll be doing natural science for 3 years. And if they want to continue your studies after that, well, so be it. So that was... that was how I got to Cambridge, and that was where I met Dick Laws, by the way, who became my great college friend.
Was he influential in your life at that point at the university?
Well, insofar as he gave me a taste for the great outdoors, and we spent... two summers climbing in the Isle of Skye, which was great fun, and we either lived in youth hostels or in a small tent. But we had a third college friend with us. But he'd also been evacuated. His school had been evacuated to. The Lake District during the war, and so he was very knowledgeable about hill climbing and so on. So I got very enthused about life in the open air. And when we finished our college degrees, he was a first class student, and in those days, which was before the end of the war, people with first class honors degrees could get deferment from the military, which Dick did, of course, by joining FIDS and going down to the South Orkneys. But I was not a first class scholar, but so they called me up for the Navy, and I spent 3 years there.
Well, can I ask you what sort of chap the young Dick Laws was? I've met him in recent years. What was he like as a young man?
Oh, absolutely fine. We got on famously, and we both played on the first 15 rugby team, but I think he spent more time in the summer months studying, whilst I was quite happy to sit in an eight and row on the can. He was a good, hardworking student in every respect, and fun to be with.
Did you suspect he might become a leader of men?
I don't know, really. In an unexpressed way, we probably thought we all might be, but I don't know. I don't recall marking him out for future leadership, but he obviously had that potential.
Tell me about your Navy years. This was just after the war, wasn't it? Well, are there any particular memories you have from that period in National Service?
Well, the interesting thing to start with was that when we went before an interview board, one of the interviewers was an instructor captain in the Navy who happened to have very close associations with St. Catharines. And I, being a student from there, said, we'll take you in the instructor branch. And I said, fine. And it turned out that you could either be trained as a meteorological forecaster, or you could learn to be a navigator and teach midshipmen how to take star shots and so on. He said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, having an interest in aviation, I thought that I could get near the Fleet Air Arm, as it then was, by being a weather forecaster. So I said, I'll happily train to be a Met man. And so that's how I ended up getting the training, which was a good solid 3 months. And then instead of being sent to, say, a naval air station or a carrier, they sent me out to the naval headquarters in Ceylon, where they had a small team to provide the East Indies fleet with weather forecasts, which was a bit tricky in those days because we really didn't get the kind of information that people get these days with satellite pictures and all that sort of thing.
So how accurate do you think you could be then all those years ago?
Well, the main thing was to try and forecast where the intertropical front was between the various monsoons, and you could only do this on the basis of a few reports from ships, and which weren't that many in the Indian Ocean at that time, and also many land stations in India. A few in Africa, and some in the Far East, but really not very much at that time. It was It was 1948 and 49 after all, and I think the military had been packing up much of their stuff around the empire, if I can put it in those terms. Anyway, it was instructive, and I enjoyed it. But I was sent back after 2 years because they decided to wrap up the headquarters there in Trincomalee in Ceylon. And I came back to England and ended up at a naval air station in Northern Ireland. And that has an interest for us because at the naval hospital there was none other than Surgeon Commander Ted Bingham.
Oh, yes.
And we all know about him. So I met him and he said, you must read my book, and produced a copy of John Rymel's Southern Lights. Have you read that, by the way? That was about the British Graham Land expedition before the war.
I think I read it many, many, many years ago.
Yeah. Anyway, there's an account of his work in there, and he was one of the principal people there. But I read his book, and he said, I had been interested in joining FIDS because Dick had written me from East Africa, where he'd been. I'm jumping ahead of the time. He'd written me from Cambridge anyway, where he was writing up his work on elephant seals at Sydney Island. And he said, why don't you join FIDS and come south and we can do things together. He was returning to South Georgia to complete the elephant seal work. I had no particular future in mind at that time. So I said, fine. And went with FIDS down to South Georgia for a year, and then to the South Orkneys for another year. So,
what do you think was the first inkling you had that there might be a place called the Antarctic? Your first contact with that continent, reading about it, or?
Oh yes, where would one have? I probably read. About Scott more than any other thing, but I think that whetted my appetite for just going and seeing other places in far off lands, and the Antarctic certainly appealed to me because, I guess, in a way, the open air experience in climbing in the mountains and sky was one thing, Then, of course, I'm jumping the gun there, aren't I? Because I suppose in the early days at school that one read about Scott, and I know there was there was some film footage which was shown at school, and there's that marvelous book by Apsley Cherry Garrard, The Worst Journey in the World, and I think that made quite an impression on me as well.
I'm surprised that didn't put you off, because it is the worst journey in the world, and of course Scott never came back.
Yes.
But had you actually then already thought about going to the Antarctic, or was it really Dick and or Ted who put the thought in your mind?
No, I think it was Dick, quite honestly, and I knew he was. When we left Cambridge, I knew he was going off to the south, and we maintained contact, and I got these marvelous letters from him, and that really encouraged me to go south when I got the opportunity.
So he was writing to you and describing his situation and his work, was he?
Yes. He described his work on elephant seals and said he was going back, but would I like to join him at South Georgia? We didn't do too much together there because I was a Met observer and also forecaster later on, but he was out with the sealers, but we did do some work on seals together, but he left when he went back to England. I went down to Sydney. He had left me his notes on seals and birds and so on, and encouraged me to do some biological work. So I chose the Weddell seal as something to work on, and that of course gave me really supplied me with my future career.
Let's come back to the zoology shortly, if I may. We have to get you to the Antarctic first, and the first stumbling block would have been the interview, I expect. Do you recall that at all?
Yes, as I say, I remember the interviewees were rather grand-looking gentlemen in their various uniforms. I think there was a fairly high ranking officer from each service, and they were picking out people they thought would have particular aptitudes for their particular service. As I said, it so happened that one of the people on board was, I think he was an honorary fellow at one time of St. Catherine's, or he may even have been at St. Catherine's just after the end of the war. But anyway, he was the one who said, we'll take you in the instructor branch, I had no particular talents for any of the other services. I would have joined the Air Force at the drop of a hat, but I only wanted to be to fly, and unfortunately I had a rather poor eyesight, so that put the lid on that one. But I had a lot of experience at school. We had a very fine cadet force, and I certainly, had I been taken into the army, I would have applied to be in one of the frontline infantry regiments, probably, because I was well trained to do that. But Navy got me.
Yeah. Did you have to do an interview for FIDS on top of that later on?
Oh yes.
What was that like?
I'm just trying to think who interviewed me. I suppose it was Bunny Fuchs.
It would be that early, wouldn't it? At Crown Agents, yeah. I expect.
That's right, yes. As I said, I had this recommendation from Ted Bingham, who I don't know whether he put in a word for me or what, but I don't recall anything remarkable in the interview, except they said, we'll have you.
Do you think it was a fairly foregone conclusion then? It was a gentleman's agreement almost before you started?
It may well have been, but I think I had a reasonable background for joining FIDS anyway. And of course, I was an experienced weather observer and forecaster.
They were in short supply, weren't they, at that time?
Well, they are the people who they really wanted at that particular time, because I think the grand days of survey and sledging were sort of waning a bit. But so it was the accent, I think, was on the net side at that time. So there was no problem, I think, in getting taken on.
Tell me about the journey south, Arthur. Do you remember the ship?
Yes, it was a Biscoe.
Right.
The first Biscoe.
The old wooden one?
Yeah, the wooden one.
What was she like to sail in?
Well, even though I was in the Navy, I wasn't a particularly good sailor. And when we ran into very bad weather, of course, I retreated to my bunk, and that was that. But she was pretty okay. She was heavily laden, of course, and I didn't think she was a sort of unworthy vessel. I think she did the job she was modified to do extremely well.
Did you stop off on the way?
We stopped briefly in the Cape Verde Islands, and also we stopped at Montevideo for a couple of days, I think, and then down to Port Stanley, of course.
What was Stanley like in the early 50s?
Well, a very small place, almost like a big English village in a way, and we weren't in Stanley for all that length of time anyway, some of it was spent loading stores on the ship and so on. So I don't recall that there was much going on at that time for us anyway, as members of the we were in some ways members of the crew at that time, helping to store the ship,
Was it the regular procedure for new FIDs to meet the governor at that point? Were you interviewed by Miles Clifford?
I don't think we must have met him,
yeah.
But I don't recall an interview as such. He may have got together a group of us, new people, and perhaps given us a pep talk or something. I really don't remember. Mm. The only thing I remember of him, of course, was in that later episode to do with the Argentine, not attack, but harassment of our people at Hope Bay.
Well, let's talk about that then, because that was you were heading south for the first time when the ship stumbled upon that. Is that right?
No, that was the second time.
Second year.
I'd been at South Georgia and was waiting in Stanley for over the Christmas period to go to Sydney, and then it was going to be a roundabout trip, and then we. As I say in my notes here, we got the information from the base that the Argentine Navy had come into the harbour where they were putting up the new base hut at Hope Bay and had made it quite clear that the people were to stop doing what they were doing and which is when. The governor intervened, and it so happened that the Birkenhead Bay, a frigate from the West Indies, was on station around the Falklands at that time, or in the Falklands, and she was in Stanley, and so the governor went aboard and took all us FIDs who were going round to the other bases and or some of the other bases, and we headed. Headed south for a couple of days in, I remember, really very unpleasant stormy weather. But of course, when we got to Hope Bay, the governor delivered his protest and the Argentine gunboat promptly up anchored and took off. And was never seen again.
What do you remember of what you were told about that? On the way south, were you being briefed as to what to do? Were you being armed or taught how to use weapons?
No. There was no indication, I think, that the Argentines would take any action against Britain over the Falklands or the dependencies. So, I think that was perhaps the first overt signs that something unpleasant might happen in the future.
So the Berghead's trip was a show of strength rather than an offensive.
Well, I suspect the Navy was there, of course, they must have been more aware of what might possibly go on in the next while. I mean, we had no idea of that, but I think, in fact, there's been a naval presence down there since that time. I'm not sure whether there was any problem requiring the Navy's presence before that time, but
you weren't heading south expecting to be in a fight then. It was a symbolic presence rather than an action station's presence.
Well, I remember as we steamed into Hope Bay that all the guns on the frigate were trained on this naval gunboat, and the chief petty officer, gunnery officer, he was all excited that we're going to see some action at last. But of course, it never expired.
Were you nervous? Do you remember?
No, I don't think so. As I recall.
Just all these poor innocent civilian FIDs being shipped down south with guns bristling. It all sounds a bit dodgy.
No, it was. I think it was muted. And anyway, I say it was that one incident. I don't know. There've been many more, of course, since. But after that, for a while, I don't think there was any display of. Of strength by the Argentine Navy. We in the Berghead Bay stayed and joined the people from Biscay who were putting up the base hut at D, which had burned down in 1948 or 49, and so that was why the Biscay was there and for a fair while. But during that time, which was February 1952, the King George VI died. And we, of course, there was a signal sent to the governor on board the Birkhead Bay. And he said, I must return to the Falklands. So what to do with all these FIDs who are going around the other bases? And so we all got back on board again. The ship went back to Stanley, and it was a while before I got from Stanley to Sydney.
Do you have any idea why it was so important for the governor to get back to Port Stanley?
No, I assumed that he was obeying diplomatic protocol and going back to his seat of government, if you like, as it were, and issuing further messages from there. Mm. So I think that was all. I didn't read anything other than that.
All right. Let's talk a bit then about your heading to South Georgia, to Gritviken. At what point did you know that you were going to be sent there rather than anywhere else?
Oh, well, I asked to be sent there.
Oh, I see. Why was that? Because of Dick?
Because of Dick.
I see.
And I think they were very happy in FIDS that people, if anybody had a choice, then, you know, that made their task a little more easy to decide who was going where. So I said, I want to go to South Georgia and work with Dick Laws. And they said, fine, no problem. Absolutely none.
Whaling was still very much underway then. What was it like to arrive at this whaling station?
Well, we were on King Edward Point, which was across the bay from Grytviken, the whaling station, and the Discovery Committee in the late 1920s and 1930s had built this really very fine lab, and for the scientists who were working at the whaling station. And so we lived there. So from the Finn's point of view, we had a very comfortable accommodation. So that was a great bonus. But the whaling station was, for me, who'd never seen a whale before, was quite exciting. They were still taking the old blue whale, and these were enormous creatures, but they were taking mostly fin whales and a few sperm whales. But to see these giants hauled out of the water onto the ramp there and processed was really quite a spectacle and fascinating, of course, from the biological point of view.
How many were there? How many FIDs were there? Six, would that be right?
That sounds right. It was Danny Borland, the forecaster, and us new people were Jack Newing, a Falkland Islander. Alan MacArthur, yes, of course. And he was a new Met man. I was a new Met man. Dick didn't come down until April, I think, to do the second phase of his elephant seal work. Ian Biggs was a Falkland Islander, and he really helped on the helped to run the station. You know, keep the we had central heating, believe it or not, and so he kept that. He maintained that very well. We got our own weather messages from Stanley. We read the Met code ourselves, but most communications were carried out by the main radio station there, which was in contact with Great Britain, and so who else? Oh, Danny Borland was the weather forecaster when I got there, but he left, I think, when Dick came, round about April of 51, and I took over his job as weather forecaster. But it was I don't know why. It was very difficult to really forecast what might happen. The nearest weather information was from Stanley itself, which was a long way away. So one got a few odd reports from the Southern Ocean, but that was about it.
I suppose the idea was for you to try and warn whaling ships about any potential storms. Is that the general principle?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. How modern was the equipment you were using? Was it the latest technology?
Well, you mean the communications equipment?
I'm thinking of the weather equipment.
I don't know how much it's changed since those days, but there was you took 3-hour observations of temperature and pressure, and you got these weather forecasts in code from places like Stanley, And I think we used to get some from South Africa too, and but that was about it. And oh, I mean, one could record the wind speed as well with a standard anemometer, but that was it. I suppose it was really quite basic stuff. I mean, one thinks now of being able to look at satellite pictures of weather formations, and that would have been regarded as a piece of cake to have that kind of information available. But no such luck in those days.
So looking back on it then, Arthur, how useful do you think you were actually being to the shipping fleets?
I really don't know. They asked us for a daily report, so they must have felt there was some use. It may have helped them in anything they were doing locally. I might add that one of the great problems in forecasting weather in a place like South Georgia is that you've got this tremendous effect of being very close to mountainous country. After all, you've got a 9,000 foot peak, Mount Allardyce, which really comes right out of the sea in several miles, this has an enormous effect on wind, for instance, and some local weather patterns. So that was a bit tricky to work with, but I tried to put down some of my ideas on that when I wrote this scientific report on weather analysis in the dependencies.
Well, what were you recommending? What changes or improvements were you recommending?
Well, at that time there was there was nothing other than sort of improving the number of stations that were providing the information, and we didn't get any from around the rim of the continent, I recall. Maybe that was just because of the bad communication problems, but I mean, I think these days you can get weather information from all the way around the Southern Ocean and all the continents, South Africa, South America, Australia, and so on. And as I say, with satellite pictures, you can make some sense out of it all. But in those days, it was, I think, just guesswork as much as anything.
Do you remember any particularly severe periods of weather or exceptional conditions?
No, living there near the mountains, you occasionally got unexpected and very strong winds, and very very gusty too. That was very noticeable at Sydney, of course, which was much more exposed to the weather from all directions, really. Yes, I mentioned one incident where we thought after our little greenhouse on Sydney had blown away that the hut itself might also disappear. But incidentally, the hut was wired down to the rocks. But I can remember at one time seeing the rafters of the hut sort of vibrating up and down as the whole place shook, and I think on one occasion we hung on to the rafters for a short while, but that was about the worst.
That was on Sydney on the 3rd of March 1952, 85 knots according to the base report.
Yes, that slamming into a small wooden hut was was quite something to behold. But
did you fear for your lives?
No, the one good thing there, of course, was down at the down near the shore, away from the base, was a very strongly built, not very large hut. This had been built by the Norwegian whalers who used to anchor their floating factory at one time in the bay there, and they kept their a lot of their ammunition stored in this small shed as a sort of safety precaution. We used it as an emergency food store, and it had everything in it that we would need if the hut blew away or burned down, and we could survive for 6 months. And one of the initial jobs when the new supplies came in was to take out that 6 month supply, put in a new 6 month supply, and then use the old supply as our supply in the base for the next year. So that was quite a thing to have to do, but we did it because it was an extremely useful safety device.
So let's go back to Grytviken then, and once you'd done all these weather recordings, you had them presumably to transmit them somehow. I guess that was by Morse, was it?
Yes. We took them to the weather the radio station, which was in the same complex there at Grytviken, and they of course had a daily. Several times daily, I think they would send that information to Stanley, and Stanley would send out an area weather forecast for a very large area of the South Atlantic.
So, how reliable were the communications in those days?
Oh, I think I don't recall they were there was any particular problem there. This was a pretty powerful transmitting station, and you know, there were a couple of enormous antennae there, and so I think they had no trouble in getting their messages out to the world. Mm.
What was social life like on South Georgia at that time? Did you rub up against the Norwegians quite a lot?
Oh yes, I can remember several somewhat riotous occasions having a meal with some of the Norwegians in their quarters. But one of our great friends was one of the administrative staff, and he spoke extremely good English, and he became our teacher in Norwegian for a while. We would have a weekly class, half a dozen of us, and I fortunately had taken south with me a book of Norwegian grammar, so. John Larson would act as school teacher, and that was good because we learned some of the vocabulary in Norwegian and some of the pronunciation, which was quite good. So I found that useful later on, but that was another connection. And
how's your Norwegian these days?
Oh. I can almost make sense of some of it if I try hard, but I haven't seen a Norwegian text for years. So.
But it was a good relationship between the Brits and the Norwegians.
Oh yes, I think so. There was a doctor there, and he was good at treating dental problems, and I remember he replaced a filling of mine, but so that was useful too.
Did you ever have any more serious injuries than that? Or illnesses?
Not that I recall at South Georgia.
There was an incident at Signy, I believe. And a case of speck finger?
Oh, yes, that is quite quite extraordinary, because I found out later that the Norwegians knew about it, but mostly from their people working in the north in the Arctic, and there'd been outbreaks in places in the Baltic and so on, people who had been working on seals and whales for that matter, and they would get this rather unpleasant affliction, which affected the usually the fingers of one hand or from and I had this what I assumed to be the same thing. It was a rather unpleasant swelling of one finger on one hand, and also this equally unpleasant enlargement of the lymph nodes in my armpit and on the same side, I couldn't actually lower my arm beyond the horizontal limb, so I invented this pneumatic splint, which was
tell me about that.
Well, that was a half-inflated Met balloon, and I held it under my arm and sort of tied my wrist to my waist, and so I walked around. I walked around for a while holding this balloon under my arm, which looked quite ridiculous, but it proved useful in the end. I think it took about 2 weeks for that infection to eventually disappear, but I used up all the base supply of penicillin, or most of it. George Marsh, who was the doctor at Hope Bay at that time, we got in touch with him, and he advised me to use penicillin on a daily basis, but after I'd used up nearly all the supply, he said, "Stop it." And it was, in fact, I don't think it was much use. They found eventually that this organism, which they seem to have been able to isolate, was it only responded to tetracycline, and which seems to be the standard treatment for it now. But it's still there. It's seals and whales somehow have this organism, if you cut your hand in dealing with them, then you best watch out, as I found. But
how much on South Georgia? How much biological work were you able to do with Dick Laws?
Not very much. Dick was away with the sealers much of the time, but across the bay, he set up a camp with a couple of pyramid tents, and that was where he did some good work on the reproductive behavior of the elephant seal, and I went across and stayed with him on the odd occasion, which meant rowing across the across the bay and staying overnight in the tent with him. But we dissected a few elephant seals, and he wanted further information on the reproductive tracts and so on, and so I I was initiated into dealing with very large mammals, which stood me in great stood me well in the future when I worked in the Arctic and had to dissect the walruses, which are really very, very large animals as well, almost as bulky as very large elephant seals.
So was there anything in your zoology degree at Cambridge that came in useful at this point?
General biological knowledge about mammals and their reproductive habits, but I mean their behaviour, for example, was something relatively new, and Dick made great strides in reporting on that. And in fact, his work on the elephant seal was seminal, and I think it's sort of led to many other important studies.
This was all new science, wasn't it? All unknown science.
Well, there had been people working in the South on seals before. Colin Bertram with the British Greenland Expedition. He worked on seals because they had to feed the dogs, and so he was appointed the chief seal slaughterer and cutter up, and so collected many samples and wrote very well. On the crab-eater seal, for instance, and the red-hill seal. There was, I'm trying to think, there was somebody working at the station at Grytviken before the war, but a sort of more casual study of the elephant seal. Not a detailed scientific study. So that was Harrison Matthews, who was director of the London Zoo for a while. And
in his report, Dick talks about you and he and Biggs on the 29th of March making a preliminary survey of the Dartmouth Point.
Yes, that's where he had this camp and studied the behaviour of the elephant seal, reproductive behaviour during the breeding season. So,
was it exciting stuff for a young lad?
Well, great, tremendous. Yes, I mean, what? yes, we're worlds apart from things like being in the military and so on. So, yes, I enjoyed it. As I say, I got the taste from going to places like Skye and climbing in the mountains there, which that in itself was quite new for a young lad brought up in the suburbs of London, and before that, so that was adventurous.
Dick makes a point that once Borland went. You were less free to help him out because of your Met duties.
Yes, that was a problem. But in fact, it was a problem at Sydney, of course, because there were three Met observers, and I was one of them. And when I was studying red-hill seals on the West Coast, I used to spend a couple of days there and come back and do my Met day and then go back again.
The latter part of your Grytviken stay, you were not able to do much biology at all, is that correct?
Not really, no.
Did he go on the reindeer hunt?
Yes, I've got pictures of that. the Norwegians like to do this, and in fact, our friend John Larson, who was the when I was telling you about, he used to teach us Norwegian. He organized a hunt on one occasion, and there's a picture of Ian Biggs there, and Jack, and I've forgotten who else. But yes, a number of us went from our place, and the reindeer weren't too far away. There was a long fjord with sort of shallow, it was exposed ground where the glacier had retreated, so there was a lot of open ground which where there was enough forage for reindeers to come, and they would come down from the foothills and graze quite happily. So we were able to get a number of those, and which were well received at the whaling station and by us, of course.
Yes, you had a cook called A. Smith, who presumably rather enjoyed the. I presume he appreciated having venison to play around with, did he?
Do you know, I've thought about that, like I can't remember. I can visualize him, but I can't remember his. I don't remember his name, and that was in 1952. 1951 was
yes.
it?
Check that. Yeah.
At Griffithgen. Yeah. Yes, it's funny.
Dick talks about doing some skiing as well, recreational skiing.
Yes, that was good. In fact, it was about the only way you could get around if you got away from the from the beach and so on. So yes, we did a fair amount of that, but not as much as we did at Signy, of course, where we had the sea ice to ski on. But
the other point he makes is that. You socialised with the Norwegians a great deal, and there was more manufactured entertainment than most bases because their base was overstaffed. The Norwegian base was overstaffed, and therefore they had time to organise billiards, table tennis, and also a showing films?
I don't recall being involved in that or even seeing a film there, come to think of it. Maybe some of the other base members did. I don't remember.
Yeah. But you obviously got involved in photography because you've mentioned it twice already, and there was a dark room at the base.
Yes, there had to be, of course, I suppose, since it was a scientific laboratory, essentially. Yes, I'm trying to picture it now. Actually, I think we did much of our. There was a bathroom there, and I think we did much of our processing in the bathroom. Come to think of it, yes. So we were reasonably well set up in that respect.
Generally speaking, do you think you were well fed, venison or no venison?
Oh yeah, very well fed. On occasion we would get whale meat, of course, from the whaling station, which is splendid stuff to eat if you if you like protein in large quantities. Yeah, I can certainly remember the skiing activity at Pesca, the whaling station, and they had built a ski jump there. And it was fascinating to watch these guys come hurtling down the mountainside and leap over the jump and soar through the air. And there was I do remember one occasion where one of the people on the station, probably the manager, had a small dog. And on this occasion, small dog trotted out and was right in the middle of the ski track. The landing area, as this guy came hurtling down the slope, and it was too late. I mean, there's nothing we could do. We watched as he sailed over the jump, and the he saw that there was a little dog standing as he were there, and as soon as he hit the snow, he did a broadside. He twisted his skis broadside and went all the way down the slope broadside with his skis and stopped just before he reached the little dog. Otherwise, he would have gone straight through it probably and killed it. But I thought, wow, I wonder if one could ever learn to ski as well as that.
When it came towards the time to leave South Georgia, what was your thinking? What were your plans?
Well, I knew I wanted to go to Sydney because Dick had said, "Well, if you go there, you can study the Weddell Seal, and there are lots of seabirds which we still don't know all that much about, there was also." On the way down, before I ever got to South Georgia, I went round some of the bases and stopped at Sydney. It was the last stop before I got to South Georgia. And of course, I met Bill Sladen there. And Bill said, "Oh, he'd done all this work on penguins, and what he'd love would be some." Panoramic shots of certain breeding areas, and so I said I would be quite delighted to do that. So there was another reason for doing that. And Dick had also said, "Well, what I'd like from Sydney is counts of elephant seals at various beaches throughout the." Throughout the season, throughout the open water season, and do you think you could do that? So developed a plan for that one. So I had a lot of
This is Arthur Mansfield, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee via Skype on the 28th of May 2013.
This was all very well worked
out. Arthur Mansfield,
as well as what I could do for myself, and so I was very happy to go to Sydney.
Okay, let's talk about that in some detail in a moment or two's time. Shall we just take a short break?